Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 46, titled Human Rights and Buddhism.
Reducing things to mind, you could say. And then there's a relativist theory, which would be the Madhyamaka theory. And a relativist / conventionalist theory, which they consider the most sophisticated theory themselves, at least in Tibet, eventually. And so the interactionist one is one of the more simplistic ones. It's at the level of a kind of realism in philosophical terminology. And so then they make it impossible for people who are involved in materialism to think of how they can deal with the mind, other than in some mysterious way that is incomprehensible to them. Whereas I tried to tell these same people in that dialogue, I said, well, actually, if you go to the most subtle level of Buddhist scientific thought, at that level, you know, and you all have been, you were exposed to that schema through the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where there's considered a gross, subtle, a gross body mind, a subtle body mind, and a super subtle body mind. If you remember those little charts in the Book of the Dead. And the gross body mind is the flesh and blood body, and then the sixfold consciousness that operates throughout the five senses, and the sixth, the mental coordinating sense, within and also with internal imaginative images and linguistic objects, mental objects. And that's the gross body mind. And then the coarse body, the subtle body mind, is the Zalung Tigle, you know, the channels, the central nervous system, the winds, which mean the movement, moving energies within that nervous system, and the drops, which are like endocrine substances, hormonal substances, you know, neurotransmitters, whatever you want to call them, some kind of fluids, and in the central nervous system. And those are the three of the subtle body, and then the subtle mind going with that are the three luminances, as they're called, which is luminance, radiance, and immanence, right? The moonlit sky, sunlit sky, and darklit sky, in which flourish the 80 instincts, which are in the moonlit sky one connected with desire mostly, in the sunlit sky one connected with aggression mostly, and in the darklit one connected with sort of sleepiness, delusion, stupidity, this kind of unconsciousness. And then the super subtle, and then I try to bring up to people, the super subtle one is where the body is considered the super subtle energies, which are in the category of wind, but not coarse wind, but super subtle, meaning energy, meaning moving matter, actually, but material. And the super subtle mind is the clear light mind, mind of transparency, which is called by convention clear light, but it's really wrong to call it light because it's not a light as opposed to a dark. The sunlit and moonlit spaces of the subtle mind are light and dark, and the darklit spaces, that's dark and light. You know, light has its opposite, which is the shadow. Whereas the clear light, which would be better translated as transparency, is, the analogy for it is a gray pre-dawn twilight, where there's enough light to see your hand, is what they say, but you can't see the lines on the palm of the hand. So it's a sort of gray thing, but in a way it's a combination of light and dark, which everything is self-transparent. So it's like glass or a diamond, a clear, translucent jewel that has no light in itself, but transmits light, right? That it's a neutral as far as light goes. So then I said to those scientists, so your problem, if you reconceive, could you work better with that problem that you're telling the Dalai Lama that you can try to do your best to think of how a non-material thing can influence causally a material thing. Instead, think of subtle influencing course. In other words, the problem is the subtle causation influencing the coarse causation. So because at the super subtle level, if you remember from the Book of the Dead, if you remember at the super subtle level, there's ultimately no difference between body and mind. The super subtle body-mind, the body-mind are not different. Which means only, since Buddhism has no absolute theory about anything, all theories about relative processes, structures, what have you, are relative. That is, contextual and valid within a certain context and useful within certain contexts. So it's a very pragmatic kind of idea about theorizing, as actually science should be. Science should be gathering evidence, experience, and evidence, experimental and experiential evidence, and then coming up with hypothetical theories that seem to account for the existing body of evidence. And then, however, always open to new evidence and experience, providing weight that then leads you to drop that theory. So it's potentially falsifiable, any theory that's valid, useful. So it's not an absolute theory. But, of course, they get into laws of nature, the standard model, the Big Bang, and these are absolutes, sort of. They're projecting into an objective realm and acting like they're absolutes. And they're going through conniptions about this dark matter and dark energy nowadays. Try to keep integrating things, string theory, 11 dimensions, whatever it is, like the epicycles that people used to do when they had the concept of ether or the concept of the terra-centric cosmologies. To account for the variations of celestial bodies, rotation or orbiting. So then they thought that was useful and interesting. But the Buddhists had decided that, got all nervous. And they were saying, oh, that's esoteric, don't say that. And the idea there is that if people can, therefore, in other words, materialistic reductionistic theories could be useful in certain contexts. It's not like anathema or sacrilege or something. And even in Buddhist medicine, anger is bile. Delusion is phlegm, of which there are five kinds of bile, five kinds of phlegm, and desire is wind, which or energy, you know, and so of which there are five kinds, five or ten kinds. So that's a kind of materialistic reductionism. And I can tell you, I used to translate for the Dalai Lama's physician when he would travel on tours, and I studied Buddhist medicine, and Tibetan medicine, and sometimes patients would come to him saying that they had some terrible neurosis, or they were like had some obsession about something, or they were like, whatever. And he would say to them, you know, well, you just eat too much like dairy, so your phlegm is too much, so you're confused. Or you eat too much hot food and weird fried food, so your bile is agitated, so you're irritated all the time. Or you don't eat enough food, and so your wind is agitated, so you're all obsessed with things, and you're nervous. So he would be reductionist, actually, in dealing with them. And I particularly used to get a pleasure, I must say, a kind of perverse pleasure about some people would come who had some very fastidious, it was before there was widespread veganism, which is actually a pretty good diet. I mean, it's more sophisticated now, but in those days there were some people who would only eat this and that and wouldn't hardly eat anything, and then couldn't sleep at night. So he would tell them to go out and have some burgers. And they would look horrified, like this Buddhist guy is starting to go and have a bunch of burgers, especially at night, so they'd have some heavy something in their stomach and they'd be able to be digesting it and fall asleep. And then, of course, one of the worst is bone soup. Go get bone soup and boil it like you get a white broth. And that's considered the ultimate sleeping pill. You have a big cup of bone soup, and you find an organic bone, please, because the marrow will contain otherwise some noxious substances in the way the meat industry works in this country. But you have to find an organic bone, but then boil that bone for a while, and you get this kind of white soup, and then it knocks you right out. It's like, it's great for sleeping. So they do have reductionist theories, in other words. But on the other hand, then that's what the Buddhists are scared of. If they acknowledge to the scientists that in the deepest, most sophisticated level of Buddhist theory, where they have the hermeneutic that no theory about relative processes can be absolute, and it's only contextually valid in a certain context, then they can deal with materialistic reductionism. It's not a sacrilege. But if it becomes a dogma, it's imprisoning to an investigator because they're not really open-minded looking at things. But it's not. It's okay if it has a usefulness in a certain context. But on the other hand, then they have to acknowledge that idealistic reductionism, that everything is generated by mind, and that mind is the most powerful force in nature, there's also idealistic reductionism, or mentalistic reductionism, you could say. And that would be the Vijnanavada school, and all of their theories and things, which is very widespread too. And of course, finally, the Madhyamaka one, it's not really either one, and almost it's a linguistic reductionism, mantra reductionism, power of language, what's called the linguistic turn that only happened in the 20th century in the West, but happened, 2,000 years ago in India, which is incomprehensible to a bunch of modernistic chauvinists who think that everything great that happened is modern. So therefore, in that sense, Buddha was doing a secularistic ethics in the way he elaborated karma. Remember, I told you that the word translated as virtue in later Buddhist languages and in English, in the original Sanskrit, was the word that was chosen. Kushala means skill. So what we would think of as a virtuous act, like saving a life or refraining from taking a life in some context, is considered skillful. And how can you consider that skillful? You consider it skillful because that is improving your evolutionary trajectory. You're embracing and identifying with larger life energy than just your own sort of inside your skin by saving another life and not taking it away. And so therefore that's skillful, and that expands your sense of identification and makes you a bigger kind of being and a more healthy and more positive type of form you seek. Okay, so that in a way is giving you, therefore, a scientific basis for doing a good ethical act within the context of that science. And therefore, it's a kind of secular ethics, if you follow me. So the Buddhist thing, that's a really important thing. For example, I don't know if any of you are philosophy majors or have studied philosophy, but if you've ever read Wittgenstein, for example, who's one of my absolute, the later Wittgenstein, one of my favorite philosophers by far, one of the greatest ones, I think, of 20th century. And he says that ethics is not a matter, there's nothing you can really reason about it, it's sort of like a personal choice. And for years I used to meet with human rights people in conferences, because they always invite, a token Buddhist, a token Muslim, a token Jew, a token whatever it is the Protestants do, who dominate that kind of conversation. And when they're token member or token Confucian, token Hindu, and say, do you guys have human rights in your tradition? Or if you don't, would you mind having one now? They assume that the Protestants, invented human rights. And nobody else ever thought of it before. And I used to, everyone loves the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Eleanor Roosevelt, I worship her. She's like the supreme Buddha goddess of America, Eleanor Roosevelt, pushing that through a bunch of uptight people who only even listen to her for a moment because they've just been through the nightmare of World War II. Otherwise, the states, don't want to have human rights. They want to boss and shoot people and do whatever they want to do, right? A state is defined in political science as the monopoly of violence within its territory. So violence is considered essential to a state, so they don't want human rights. But she managed to shove it down their throat in 1947 with the founding of the UN, and it's really great. However, as I pointed out to them, the reason that human rights, although great, finds itself really hard to get anybody to respect them in populations, their governments. I don't know if you all know that statistic. In the 20th century, more people were killed by their own governments than by enemies in war. other enemies in war. That is a known fact. You know, the greater killings than in world wars between nations were nations killing their own people in some sort of internal oppression of some ethnic minority or something like that within their territory. So that is a known fact. It's like this fact, you know, everybody's so worried about the terrorists, you know, coming and the immigrants in Europe and here, you know. Donald Trump is out there building walls all over the place. Moron. He's like building lots of walls and fantasy walls. But if you look at the statistics, since 9/11, 45 people have been killed by known terrorists. Individual, like not the World Trade, I think a couple of thousand were killed, but so that doesn't count them. But 45 in some sort of lone wolf sort of thing, you know, is the statistic that I read. And during that same time, 49 people have been killed by loonies like Timothy McVeigh or others who are just local freaked out people with the extra guns, you know, who are not inspired particularly by terrorists. But they themselves were just nuts, that's all. And during that same period, 200,000 people have been killed in ordinary murders. In ghettos and in whatever. People since 2001, 200,000 people have been killed in murders in the United States. So why are we scared of a few terrorists? when our Congress people can't keep guns out of the hands of people like they do in England and other places, under the idea that whatever, you know, I don't know. So the problem that I used to challenge after long debate and discussion, and actually I would always argue that human rights were totally there from the beginning. Even the idea that Buddha was asserting his human right, Prince Siddhartha was asserting his human right to seek his own flourishing and fulfillment as a human individual rather than serve the community as a king at the wish of his father and of his society, because he wasn't considering that he was able to really help people who he was supposed to be helping as their ruler with what their real problems in life were, which were not simply foreign defense and health, welfare, and economy, but health, economy, and welfare, but were death, birth, old age, misery, mental anxiety, and so on and so on, all the suffering. So his leaving the palace and running away from his sworn family duty was asserting his human right as an individual. It's like the original archetypal moment in Indian history where the individual says, I have a personal fulfillment, duty to fulfill beyond my duty to my community, which is the boundary between individualism and collectivism. It's right there. You can find it right there. And later, we didn't really read that in this course, but sometimes I read Nagarjuna's advice to the king in the jewel rosary or precious garland, as the current translation is well known, translated in English, where he says to the king, after a lot of advice to the king, he then says, well, as a king, you may find it difficult to be ethical and to develop yourself as a person, and you may find that you're getting corrupted by being a king, and so you're not really doing your sort of own self-developmental job worth anything, in which case, abdicate. And it's not that important to be a king. It's much more important to develop yourself internally. And if you're undeveloped internally and anti-spiritual and become greedy and crazy, then you'll cause more harm as a king than you will as a sort of private individual. So that's, again, a total, the king is the absolute one who has to fulfill, serve the community. But the idea that that's not even as important as developing the individual, that, again, is total individualistic principle. So human rights, since human rights were evolved, it grew from Les Droits de l'Homme, you know, Rousseau, French Revolution, etc., right away in France, they started like beheading everybody. And then that sort of coincides with the takeoff of European colonial domination of the planet when a lot of genocides and things occurred. So I used to challenge my human rights colleagues and saying, guys, the thing is, Why should somebody be ethical and observe others' human rights? Why? Do they have actually a reason? Except that maybe it'll be a bad reputation if they don't. Maybe they'll be, they'll be caught if they kill people and they'll be put to death themselves and won't be successful. But other than such immediate circumstantial concerns, there's no deep inner reason based on the nature of reality why you wouldn't just do whatever you could get away with in a materialist worldview. And particularly because the results of any negative actions that you do not redound upon yourself, especially because you don't have a future life and you just drop dead, and then you're exempt from whether you're a good person or a bad person, a robber, a murderer, or a saint, it's the same. So it was a waste of time to become a saint. And good luck if you're a murderer. But whatever it is, the punishment will only be in this life. And it's all over when you just don't exist again. So I used to challenge them like that. And then they would go, just roll their eyes. Because modern ethical thing provides no basis within reality for why you should be ethical. Except local circumstances. It's, you get along better with a few people if you're not beating them over the head. Supposedly, although some people feel they get fine if they have everybody terror, they think they should control things around them by fear, by making people afraid of them. But some people actually think that. So, people in sort of leadership positions, some of them, they think that's the way to be. So what he's doing, the Dalai Lama, is fitting in the tradition, totally following Siddhartha, Sakyamuni. But of course, he's going to what is the consensual scientific consensus in the world here. And perhaps he's being kind of optimistic because he's looking at a science that is not necessarily the super mainstream. It's kind of innovative. Because it is a known fact, if you look in history, that in militaristic societies, the anthropologists, or the equivalent of the anthropologists, tend to say that human nature is basically violent, and therefore human beings have to be controlled by force. For example, if you look in ancient China, it is said that, I think it's fair to say that Confucius didn't pronounce a kind of overall thing about human beings are basically good or basically bad. He didn't do either. But what he did say was that human beings are very highly educable, and that the whole secret is education. And so there was this idea of junza, of making, of course he was male chauvinist because society was at that time. So he said the idea of junza was to make a human being through education become a gentle person, a junza, a gentleman. And I'm afraid his wife was just cooking, Confucius. But anyway, some people could become scholars and gentlemen, and they could craft themselves into being a fine vessel of Li, of gracious interactive sort of formalism, which they translate as propriety. It's really boring translations because they had too many fortune cookies, Confucian scholars in general. So they think he was only into propriety somehow, like proper. But Li actually is a term, the term Li, and I'm sorry about my tone. Anybody who speaks Chinese, I'm sure it's wrong. Is that Li? I don't even remember. L-I. But the character is the character of a bowl and something flowing into the bowl, and has to do with a ritual, sacrificial ritual, and the bowl is a bowl of blood, offering the sacrificial animal of the ancient Zhou dynasty's ritual. And it means that this kind of behavior, where you integrate a kind of harmonious way of interrelating with other people according to what is the most gracious and harmonious way of interacting, and that's what's proper. And so it's much, I like to translate it as graciousness, Li, and grace, because in a ritual which is done well, like in church or in synagogue or in whatever particular place you might have gone, even if you're currently a modern free thinker or something, but you might have as a child gone somewhere. There's supposed to be, if someone does a ritual right, there's supposed to be, with true sincerity, so there's a moment of a feeling of grace, of presence of the divine or something magical or some communal thing, feeling of unity with others, sort of lifting you out of a habitual way of being. And that's, we have that as a concept of grace. And so graciousness, I think, is a great translation for Li, in case you know any Confucian scholars. But because that's what it is. That's the ideal in Confucian society. By educating yourself, you have a graciousness. And there's a wonderful book by a psychologist, actually, called Herbert, if anybody's interested in Confucianism, by Herbert Fingaret, Fingaretté, called Confucius, the Secular as Sacred. And he makes some mistakes about Chinese language because he's not a sinologist. But in a way, he gets the essence of it, I think, better than many sinologists do. Although they could properly criticize him, and they did. He wrote it 30 years ago, maybe 20. Criticized him for making some mistakes in the language, in his interpretation of certain linguistic things. But still, his case is basically very, very good about the graciousness. So the idea is that the human being is sort of a rough-cut diamond and can become very vicious and nasty and horrible, or can become really very gentle and wonderful. And it's all a question of education. And when you get educated in Li, then you can harmoniously, naturally express sort of a sacred harmony like that you would otherwise do only on Sunday or Saturday or Friday, depending on when your Sabbath is in whatever culture, and when you want to be sort of on your best behavior. So that people then naturally are on their best behavior interacting with them. But then among his greatest followers, Confucius, there's Mencius and there's Xunzi. Mengzi and Xunzi are the two main ones. Mencius and, what do they call Xunzi in English? I forgot. But and Xunzi sort of says, well, humans are basically rough. So then he more emphasizes that the state needs to have a kind of strong policing of people to keep them in line. But he doesn't go all the way to what were called in ancient times the legalists, who think that humans are really awful wild animals and have to be completely controlled by police state. He didn't go that far, but he was a little on that side. And then Mencius was on the other side, that humans were basically compassionate and gentle, more like the, although that was before Buddhism was in China. And he's wonderful. I love Mencius. And he has the famous thing about anybody sees a baby in a village square, like leaning over a well, like curiously, some sort of infant, you know, helpless infant, anybody, even a stranger passing through, will kind of dive over and pull that baby back. It's like an instinctual thing in a human being, and that's a famous thing he mentions. So therefore, he indicates that humans have this basic thing, which I think that's very similar to what Dalai Lama has. And in Chinese history, in times when things were flourishing and people were kind of okay, Mencius was much preferred by people. And in times when things were chaotic and crazed, in the decadent times of dynasties and so on, when there was a lot of dislocation and class division and a lot of poor people and diseases and famines and things, then the Xunzi side, and actually China was pulled together in a single unity where the name China comes from, the Qin dynasty, which was a very short-lived 25-year-long dynasty, by a legalist who had no use for Confucius at all. In fact, destroyed all of the Confucian literature that he could find during the late 3rd century before the Common Era. And he found that usual dictators and fanatics do, found that a 10,000-year-long dynasty that lasted for 15 years or 10 years after he died. Because Chinese people don't like to be bossed around any more than any other people, contrary to what Lee Kuan Yew said, the head of Singapore. They are really not into being bossed. No human beings like to be bossed around and like whipped and go here and work all day and whatever, 27-hour work day. Forget about it. Nobody likes that. Confucius himself, contrary to his fortune cookie reputation, when he was asked what would he most like to do if he had his brothers, how would he like to spend his day? And he said, bottle of wine, springtime, down by the earth altars in the bend of the stream or the river, crowd of boys and girls wearing feathers and in their festival costumes, playing the flute and drumming and dancing in the spring fertility dances, and me hanging out on the side of the event and sipping on the wine, on the good wine. That's my way of spending time. Very much not what Lee Kuan Yew would recommend to the good, hardworking citizens of Singapore, I think. But I like that. Therefore, Gore Vidal especially liked Confucius when he reviewed the great, brilliant Gore Vidal. He ranked all the great Asian philosophers. He particularly liked Confucius, I think. He liked that. So anyway, that's what he's doing in Beyond Religion, the Dalai Lama. And in that he's saying, I'm not saying this because he wants people to think. I'm not saying be nice. I'm not saying join my common human religion of kindness because I'm a Buddhist telling you that. I'm saying that's the nature of human life. And of course, human beings, and of course, this fits with the Buddhist science also, but he doesn't say that because he knows they're going to then think it's some Buddhism, it's some religious thing. But in the Buddhist science, of course, there's no ultimate nature of anything. Nothing has an absolute nature of anything, this or that. That's first of all. We know that by emptiness, right? But within sort of conventional causal trends, as I think I've explained to you at length in different contexts, the human life form comes from ethics. The causal complex of causes and conditions that produces a being wanting to be a human and gravitating toward the human form, and therefore in the Book of the Dead description of how you get reborn, choosing a bunch of human parents rather than some armadillo parents, or turtle parents if you're particularly paranoid and like to be in a shell, with a hard shell over there and weren't too much worried about becoming turtle soup, then when you're in that floating dream state, like in the Book of the Dead, is ethics, in the sense that the human being has this incredible self-restraint, self-awareness, self-transformational capacity that other animals don't have, and so easily, and therefore you can really focus on interaction with other beings. It's a very interactive life form. The infant is helpless for 10 years, as he points out in this Beyond Religion, and is dependent on the kindness of strangers, because the parents are strangers to them at first, even though they think he or she is the most beautiful thing that ever existed. Dotted parents do, but which is very lucky that they do, but for the child, but actually they're strangers until they get to know each other, and they are conditioned to know each other. So it's not an obvious choice to be a human being. We think it's the most normal thing in the world to have two eyes, a nose, an ear, two ears, a mouth, all our senses located mainly in our face except for the sense of touch, and then walking around on two legs and having a sore back because you used to run around on all fours, not be able to hold a tree branch with your tail so you can hang out and swing and eat a mango and hold on with your tail. It's not obvious that the human is a great form. It's not. We're like wimpy. We like sprain things easily. We catch malaria. So it's fitting in an ancient tradition to do this. And so that's the thing, okay? So about that Beyond Religion.